I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 8th of June. Walter Kern has an interesting piece in the June issue of Harper's titled The Improbability Party. He joins us this hour. Walter is a journalist whose work has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, the New York Times Book Review, GQ, Vogue, New York, and Esquire. He's a novelist whose books Thumbsucker and Up in the Air have been turned into major motion pictures. It is the day now when we know that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump will be the Democratic and Republican nominees for the presidency. It's been a real weird cycle when it comes to polling for all of this. Donald Trump is up, Donald Trump is out, Donald Trump is going to be gone, Donald Trump is strong again, and on it goes. And he reminds us of what happened with Michigan and what happened with Nate Silver, in which he predicted with 99% certainty that Hillary Clinton would win the state of Michigan, and of course she did not. He talks about the improbability factor, unpredictable factor in his piece, and says that, you know, we're spending a lot of time watching CNN at home. The thing is that cable TV is predicting for us is our own behavior at the polls. It makes us at once the audience and the spectacle, and it may be the real reason why in this election season no one can seem to get anything right. Millions of Americans won't let them. The supporters of Trump and Sanders seem at times like two very separate wings of a new party. The improbability party. It's hard to predict because unpredictability is almost a principle for them. Perhaps they equate it with freedom. We're going to be welcoming phone calls. It was a big primary day yesterday, and we want to give you a chance to respond to what happened yesterday in the country, what happens now with Clinton and with Trump, and what happens with Bernie Sanders, and why the polls have been just many of them very wrong during this season. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Walter Kern. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Hi, Walter. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi there. Glad to be here.
From your article, I would assume that you were a little bit unhappy that Bernie Sanders didn't take the nomination.
Well, I try to stand back on an Olympian platform when I look at politics this year. So, you know, I'm not specifically unhappy with what happened. But, you know, like most Americans, I tend to be champion of the underdog, and there was no way watching this election not to be affected by Sanders' underdog zeal, energy, and the amazing success with which he nearly toppled not just a candidate but a kind of institution.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about that Michigan Democratic primary. Nate Silver has been all the rage. He's been spot on with so many of his polls. 538's blown prediction of the Michigan Democratic primary was pretty astounding. And Trump's rise and fall and rise and fall. He's not going to be around. Yes, he's going to be around. Oh, my goodness, he's the nominee. Were pretty remarkable events that happened this go-around.
Well, okay, Silver is so interesting because, you know, in the previous presidential election, he was hailed as some kind of, you know, Delphic oracle, a guy who,
yes.
You know, a statistician who had somehow, you know, reached into the slipstream and come up with a divine formula for predicting political outcomes. You know, and then this election comes, and he gets almost everything. And pretty much all the important things, completely wrong. I mean, he was wrong again, again, and again about Trump, and specifically about Sanders and Clinton in certain instances, which all went to show that he can predict anything as long as it's predictable. But, of course, all we want from prophets is the ability to predict the unpredictable, and that he has shown a terrible inability to do. One of the reasons, I think, is that polling is not, you know, just a sort of numb, objective statistical enterprise. People who are the subjects of polls also read polls. And I think there's nothing we like less as human beings, and certainly as Americans, than being taken for granted, than being told, you know, I know exactly what you're going to do. Yeah, you never change. To me, you're sort of almost robotic. Well, people, and especially people with political souls, don't like to be thought of that way. And so I think America has almost defiantly strayed out of the pen, out of the statistical center, to make itself heard.
Mm-hmm. And what seemed to be happening to me, Walter, is that nobody saw Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders. They just didn't see them. And as a result, the reporting or lack of reporting that took place on what this meant for the country and who these people were was not non-existent, but they certainly didn't report on either one of these people early on to the extent that they probably should have been reported on to give us an understanding of what this was all about.
Well, you know, some of that has to do with the nature of the news media in our age of, you know, profit-driven corporate journalism. And here's something to consider. Reporting, getting down on the ground, sending actual people on actual planes with actual plane tickets who have to stay at hotels out into the world is a very expensive business.
Mm-hmm.
Setting wise-looking individuals on seats in a studio and having them mouth predictions that, you know, may or may not come true and which they won't be held to in any case is relatively inexpensive. And so we've got a lot of bookies on TV. We've got a lot of touts, but we don't get as much down in the dirt reporting anymore. And so, you know, when there is a popular uprising, when there is sort of a fervent political season of change at hand, the media has no one in place to observe it.
And then they don't have too many reporters there, or for some reason they've decided that we wouldn't be interested in this. Give us some historical perspective. Talk about other elections. Talk about other people who have been similar to these candidates, how the past informs the present. We don't get much of the past. We don't get much of the present. Present, all we get, as you say, the news media during the future, because covering it requires so little reporting.
Right. And you know, what little we get of the past tends to be, I'm sorry, cliched, hyperbolic, and sometimes fairly irrelevant. So in Trump's case, we hear a lot about Nazi Germany. We hear a lot about Hitler, and we get all sorts of, to my mind, pretty hysterical comparisons to European fascism. What we don't get are comparisons to the American precursors for Trump, people like, you know, William Jennings Bryan, and, you know, Father Coughlin,
right,
and so on, and other successful populist politicians, you know, Huey Long, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So a really terrible job of contextualization has been done in this case. A lot of it meant just to, you know, make people's hair stand up, you know, thinking, oh my gosh, you know, it's Kristallnacht.
Let's talk about Trump for just a moment. Why is it that we had this up and down and up and down with him? You end your article by saying, this is what people said, Trump is finished, Trump is really finished, Trump is really, 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 well, we don't know what he is anymore.
Yeah.
People just couldn't get him at all. Why not?
Trump was really, really finished until he really, really won.
Right, exactly.
and some of the reasons, I think, are cultural. You know, especially in the cable TV media, reporters and commentators you know, are pretty fancy people. They tend to mix with the political establishment. Mm-hmm. They live in New York City and Washington and so on. And Donald Trump and his ilk are just not, you know, part of their scene. And it's always easy to underestimate the outsider, you know, the kid who walks in off the street to play baseball. Oh, he can't hit a pitch. Well, you know, just watch. So I think there was a factor of just sort of unfamiliarity. Also with Trump, it seems to be the case that large degree of his support comes from, you know, what's called the white working class. And no class is less apparent to the national media than this one. I mean, you know, NBC and CNN know as much about what goes on in Toledo, Ohio, as I do about what goes on in Timbuktu. And so here was a constituency that, you know, maybe because it isn't heavily advertised to or particularly appealing to, you know, corporate sponsors, just doesn't show up. Mm-hmm. But then suddenly you saw in the newspapers, and David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, was an example. All these writers declaring that they were going to go out and sort of make some sort of you know, jungle exploration of flyover country in order to divine where this Trump fellow got his support, and you know, and the result of that's been, to my mind, a lot of sort of patronizing reporting about, you know, desperate folks in desperate straits, you know, addicted to opiates, you know, jobless, etc. And that's tended, I think, to deform the picture of Trump on the downside, forgetting that, you know, he won a Republican primary, and a lot of Republicans are people with money.
Mm-hmm. And what about Bernie Sanders? Here was somebody, I think you can rightfully say, that he was ignored by so many, and he did. Let's go back to the Michigan primary for a moment. He won that by a lot. He won a lot of states. He has millions and millions of supporters, and he wasn't treated as though he was anything substantial. He really was.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, Hillary Clinton's candidacy, which has been in the works for, you know, I don't know, since the 19th century, it feels like, you know, was a very familiar topic to the press. You know, they knew her, her advisors, her circle, her husband, obviously. They had phone numbers for all of them. And, you know, in the way that cable TV works now, there's a revolving door between the political establishment and the media. You know, you see all the time former Clinton advisors, campaign staffers, and so on, you know, wearing the hat of pundits on TV. Well, Bernie Sanders' circle didn't extend into the newsroom that way. You know, he didn't have surrogates planted in, you know, in every press room. And so, you know, that's why that happened, as far as I'm concerned. Also, in a strange way, because his support tended to be so youthful, and because young people have yet to enter the corridors of power in our society, you know, the Clinton crew is middle-aged, mid-career, and at the peak of its influence. Mm-hmm. The Sanders revolution consisted of people who often haven't even started their careers, you know, don't have much leverage, and are easily, I think, generalized about, and so that was part of why he wasn't taken seriously. Also, I don't think, you know, the powers that be could believe that a self-declared socialist could be anything but a novelty candidate in America. It had been so long since, you know, Eugene Debs or whoever might be Sanders' precursor.
We're going to welcome phone calls, and we'll start taking calls in a moment. We have yet to get to Walter's trip to Las Vegas, where he met with the real thing when it comes to being a pollster, vice president of a firm called CG Technology, an innovative gaming technology and risk management solutions provider. So he looks at bookies and pollsters and what he learned about polling, presidential polling, as a result of having a long conversation with Jason Symbol in Las Vegas. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now. Our email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Walter Kern is our guest. We're talking about a piece that's in the June issue of Harper's, The Campaigns of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, Hard to Predict Because Unpredictability is Almost Principle for Them. And we're talking about the results of yesterday's primary as well. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Walter, and let's start our calls with Mike in Plymouth. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Mike.
You sound like a eulogy for Bernie Sanders, and it's just starting to get interesting.
How so?
I want to give you some heads up. These Bernie Sanders supporters are not bobbleheads. I mean, they don't take orders from the top dog. They're basically there is so much anger. There is so much disenfranchised I would call them recovering Democrats and actually Republicans who are now starting to get interested in the campaign of political consequences, particularly for the superdelegates who are defying the will of the people. For example, there is now a recall Tammy Baldwin effort because Tammy Baldwin is defying the will of Wisconsin primary voters and going against the voters. So now there are those rascal Democrats who are going out there and making the people realize that it's the voters who count. So there's a recall Baldwin effort starting up in some parts of Wisconsin.
Is that a significant movement, though, Mike?
Well, it should scare the heck out of those Hillary complainers who think that we should just go away. And I tell you what, every time Hillary speaks, she creates even more animosity. I call it a condescending arrogance that seems to be infiltrated throughout the Clinton campaign that only enlivens the Bernie Sanders supporters to basically take back their party. Mm-hmm. And this is not over. It won't be over till the end of the convention, and I'll tell you right now, Chicago 1968 could happen all over again if Hillary doesn't get it before the convention.
Walter, what do you think?
Well, you know, your caller has some very good points. I was living in Las Vegas, just recently when there was a Nevada Democratic convention that fell into heated, chaotic conflict mm-hmm. over what appeared to me to be a rather high-handed tactics by the Clinton forces. I think it's pretty obvious to anybody who's honestly observing the situation that the Democratic Party machinery, and in a year when parties at themselves, I think, are really in peril, this structure built a path for Hillary Clinton that was almost almost insurmountably steep for everybody else, and the Sanders wing is, I think, a genuinely radical force that is in some ways like many of the Trump people profoundly anti-authoritarian, and in this year of real anti-elitist suspicion and a sense on both sides that the economic and political establishments have allied themselves in a sort of pact that excludes the people, I would not want to be Hillary Clinton, because if anything, she seems to represent, in a year of turmoil, the forces of sort of consistency, orthodoxy, and dare I say conservatism. I know a lot of Sanders supporters. I'm out here in Montana. Political grassroots activity, happens right in front of my face here. It's not something hidden in big buildings. People are very angry, and the Democratic Party, there's a lot of talk about the fractures in the Republican Party. The Democratic Party is in crisis, as far as I can see, because a lot of people new to the political system and very observant and very sensitive saw what they believed to be a rather undemocratic process played out at their expense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's right. It's not going to stop now. The media has really played a strange role this year. As I say, they played the role of predictor, and they got everything wrong. In the case of Hillary Clinton, and especially in the case of CNN, there's been a kind of attempt to create inevitability through hypnosis, and so. Today, we're almost getting a surplus of, Hillary Clinton triumphant news. But the news world and the real world are disjunct as almost never before, it seems. And what you see on TV and what you read in the paper is not any more reliable guide to events.
When you talk about this anti-authoritarian feeling, though, among Americans, does that extend to the Republican Party? Because Donald Trump has been described by so many as an authoritarian figure.
Yeah. Well, personally, I kind of understand roughly why someone would describe him that way. But I could also really sort of repudiate that description in the following way. What structure does Donald Trump command? What institutional power does he wield? What set of orthodoxies is he promoting? Authoritarianism isn't just sort of a matter of strutting, boasting, and colorfully expressing oneself. It involves working the levers of power in a systematic and ruthless way. And so far, he's kind of a freelancer.
Let's go. Mike, thanks very much for your call. We go to Ron in White Lake next. Hi, Ron.
Hello. Great program. I agree that it seems like the media is giving Hillary a pass. I'll give two examples. In the caucus states, the DNC seems to be refusing to release what the individual citizen vote numbers are. Instead, what we get is this, just the caucus group winners and loser numbers, not the individual citizen votes. Bernie won a lot of those states. I wish the media would do some digging and find that out. The other thing is, why is the media not pressing Hillary for those transcripts from the Wall Street speeches? What promises did she make for all that money? How come they're beating up Trump on these kind of periphery issues, but they give Hillary that pass? Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Walter.
Yeah. Well, I in my lowly Twitter feed called early on and rather incessantly for the release of those transcripts. I think that it's outrageous that the press has not dogged her on that topic. I mean, do you remember in 2008 when a sort of underground video emerged of Mitt Romney speaking to some rich supporters about the 47% of people who were relying on government would never vote for Republicans, etc. You know, that was a very clarifying and moment, and the press, I think, was justly proud of itself for bringing it about. The parallel moment with Hillary is yet to come, and it really does baffle me. I mean, not only did she take all this money from Goldman Sachs, her husband has taken much more and given many more speeches. Her son-in-law, runs a hedge fund, which was substantially funded by the chairman of Goldman Sachs. We have every right to know how this extremely powerful institution and a potential president have interacted, and yet it seems to be the culture of the press these days not to be adversarial in the great tradition of Woodward and Bernstein, say. I mean, I'm of an age, 53, which is especially frustrating because I remember a period of sort of crusading anti-establishment media, which really did, afflict power with inconvenient truths. And that just doesn't seem to be the case anymore.
Let's go to Kathy next in Sun Prairie. Hi, Kathy. You there, Kathy?
Yes.
Go right ahead.
Yes, I'm sorry. The question I have is, would have Trump been able to capture the Republican Party's nomination had he not had, I don't know how many, there were 8 debates, which became like circuses, which became like great television viewing. It was better than some of the television, my favorite television shows. and it seemed to me that if there were only 1 or 2 debates, Trump would not be where he is today. What do you think about that,
Trump was on TV almost continuously.
All the time.
The debates were almost, formal respites from the nonstop stream of consciousness that Trump was unleashing on the American media. So debates or not, he commanded attention hour after hour and day after day. What's interesting about the outcomes for both parties is that in the case of the Republican Party, there seems to have been less party discipline. The party was not able to enact its will. It obviously didn't approve of or like Donald Trump, and yet it finally had to yield to him. In the case of the Democratic Party, which I think tends to be a more competent and thoroughly organized institution, there was the ability to put forward a candidate who, might be very flawed, but because they were pre-approved, was also successful.
Do you think the Republican Party will continue to yield to Trump if he continues to call out judges?
Well, I don't know what is left of it to yield in some way. Mm. It's kind of a joke among political reporters that there is no Republican Party, that it's really a kind of brand in search of a product, and this time the product came about in a unpredictable way, but I think it's love it or leave it with Trump as far as Republicans go. I think the Republican convention in Cleveland, may be a vastly diminished affair, because political conventions, I don't think people realize, are kind of like Super Bowls. They're heavily sponsored by corporate donors. There's a lot of people have skyboxes, and there's all kinds of cocktail party activity, and I don't think Trump's gonna attract as much of that as, you know, as a Mitt Romney would or something.
Mm-hmm.
He's here to stay, and there's not going to be, it looks like, any sort of rival, in a third party setting that approved by establishment Republicans. So, you know, what you see is what you get right now.
Thanks, Kathy, for your call. Jake in Oshkosh. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. I'd like to ask you, yes. To my way of thinking, this is the marriage of corporate government with corporations and corporate media. I mean, it's a marriage made in heaven, and it's a long marriage of corporate government and corporate media. Kathleen, you don't hear about Donald Trump and the Panama law firm, Paseco, and 3,540 leaked documents, which names Trump. You don't hear about Hillary Clinton and Goldman Sachs and most transcripts. It's corporate media and corporate government.
Well, you know, your perception is the perception that is driving what I call the improbability party. There's a sense that, the fix is in. One thing that happened this year is people got an incredible crash course in the power and structure of political parties to choose for us. And they saw, in ways I think they hadn't seen before, how these institutions, reduce our choice and operate hand in glove with other societal powers. And I don't think that genie is ever going to be put back in the bottle. This may be the year in which political parties became permanently suspect. And, as far as the corporate influence, I mean, there's really no rival to that sort of influence in politics these days, other than the ability of a Bernie Sanders to put together, scads of little contributions using the internet and so on. I think in that way, he sort of built on something that Howard Dean did back when, Barack Obama furthered, and that may spell doom for the traditional fundraising mechanisms that depend on parties and big Hollywood get-togethers with $45,000 a seat. He really showed that it was possible to come up out of the grassroots with a lot of bucks.
Well, let's predict the future because that's what the press has to do these days. But let's say that Trump goes down to a huge defeat in November. Hillary Clinton wins very large due to the historic nature of her candidacy. It will be a big deal. She's the first woman president. That's where the press centers its attention. Don't all of those forces, those Trump forces and Sanders forces, lose and just kind of go by the wayside? How do they figure into a permanent changing of the guard?
Well, I mean, you just made a lot of really huge and not necessarily well-founded assumptions. First of all, that either side could win in a landslide this year. I mean, it may be ironically true that in the end, should Hillary Clinton win, that the candidate who probably any computer could have chosen in 2009 will have prevailed. In other words, in an age of superficial tumult and all this, unpredictable, chaotic, fevered behavior, when the smoke clears, the statistical favorite may win out. But whatever happens, I'm not one who thinks that the people who have supported Sanders and Trump are going to sort of go back quietly to their cubicles or to their places in the political system. They've had a taste of something. And the fact is, there is reality underneath all this. And the reality seems to have to do with people's economic fortunes, their sense of their prospects. And until those change, the agitation that they've created is not going to subside.
Well, you have to look at what happened in the state of Wisconsin. Everything changed in the state of Wisconsin, and there were massive protests and a recall election. And you have to wonder what's happened to the Democratic Party in this state and to all of those people whose livelihoods were affected. If they were just kind of, well, you know, the odds are too great, you're beaten down, we're downtrodden. There has not been, for some time now, an effective protest against what many thought was a government that did them wrong.
Yeah, after all battles, and especially battles that are hard fought and then lost, there tends to be a period of quiet, but you know, energy doesn't disappear. It always reformats and takes new shapes, and anybody who's expecting that sort of conflict to never appear again, I think, is wrong. If we've learned anything this year, it's this: it's that out of nowhere, storms build. Out of a clear blue sky, candidates and movements that are hard to imagine the day before can change the climate. And you know, how stupid would it be for us to collapse back into a sense of quiescence and quietude after this? America has sort of seen its own capacity to generate novelty. And Americans like new things. You know, one time a Trump person was talking to me, an anti-Trump person was talking to me, and I said, you know, in some ways it might not be that complicated. America likes to try new stuff, and Donald Trump looks like new stuff. And, you know, even Bernie Sanders, you know, as gray-haired as he was new stuff. And you know, I actually think it's a tribute to American dynamism that we tinker, we try to invent and innovate. And you know, as scary as that might seem in this case to some people, I think that's the dynamism that's on display.
We welcome our phone calls. Walter Kern is our guest this hour. He has an interesting piece in the June issue of Harper's titled The Improbability Party, that the campaigns of Trump and Sanders were hard to predict because unpredictability is almost principle for them. We're talking about their campaigns, what the press missed, what the press has become, and the results of yesterday's mini primaries and the election ahead. Here's our phone number. One line is open for you, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to phone calls for Walter. Richard in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Kathleen and guest. I have a question about superdelegates. I wonder if the Republicans wish that they had superdelegates might have been a way to deal with Donald Trump. And also I wonder about the background of the system with the Democrats, if there was maybe a similar situation way back when and they thought that would be a good idea.
Well, I mean, on the Democratic side, superdelegates really, were an insurance policy for Hillary Clinton and an almost impregnable insurance policy, it turns out. I remember years ago when Ross Perot was running for the Reform Party, I did some reporting on that group, and I learned a lot about political parties. And they're very strange institutions. They have a kind of headlock on our politics, and yet you know, they're not sanctioned by the government or the Constitution or anything else. You know, they've won their power over the years through all sorts of legislation and other things. And you know, I think the Democratic Party finally emerged as a much more you know, effective you know, purveyor of power than the Republicans did. You know, the Republicans seemed to rely a lot on gentlemen's agreements, and this was not the year for those.
And the Democrats, if my memory serves me correct, started this system after McGovern, didn't they? That they wanted to ensure that somebody wouldn't lose. They thought of him perhaps as a too radical a candidate, and so they wanted to ensure that the party had some control over who the nominee would be so the person wouldn't lose by as large a margin.
You know, and here's the thing. We don't know how this reliance on superdelegates will play out for the Democrats. In some ways, it created a sort of artificial environment in which Hillary Clinton, you know, was likely to prevail. On the Trump side, he had to sort of survive this Darwinian battle royal against all sorts of other candidates. You know, and he emerged a guy, you know, who, in whatever else you may say about him, knew how to crank people up. Hillary has, by in some ways having the nomination half-handed to her, not had to compete so rigorously. And so when they both come out on stage for this phase, you've got a Trump who kind of, you know, came up through a you know, a series of wrestling bouts, and a Clinton who, you know, squeaked through by virtue of, I think, institutional inertia to some extent. And should she lose, I think a lot of people will look back and say, wow, you know, the Democrats with their superdelegates created an insulated candidacy that wasn't really wildly appealing, while the Republicans, you know, let someone sort of emerge from a real true tournament.
Let's go to Diane next in Milwaukee. Hi.
I understand from Donald Trump's book, The Art of the Deal, that he says if people want to believe exaggeration, all the better. He's just telling people what they want to hear, that jobs are coming back. And he has an intention of signing any Republican bill that comes in front of him, even though he says not right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, politicians telling people what they want to hear. Is that so new? I mean, I think some of the outrage and disgust with Trump is that he has just, you know, adopted at a kind of insanely intense level all of the sort of principles of modern politics. Tell people what they want to hear. You know, change with the polls. You know, tell one group one thing, tell another group another. And he's unapologetic about it. And a lot of people, I think, are just shocked to see a politician being, you know, uncompromisingly unprincipled in some ways. And yet he'd probably claim that, you know, this is what happens. This is how it works. This is the game. This is the business.
We have yet to talk about your meeting at the Cosmopolitan Deluxe Casino in Las Vegas, where you learned about polling and bargaining and gambling, really. Why did you go there? What did you learn?
Well, you know, first of all, I perceived that, as we said already, a lot of political reporting and political media now is basically devoted to making book on candidates, to making predictions. So I went to a real bookmaker in a real casino in Las Vegas to find out how that process works. And the first thing that struck me, and the most ironic thing, was that this sports book in the Cosmopolitan Hotel with all its big screen TVs and sort of flashing technology looked like nothing more than, you know, the Situation Room on CNN or Shepard Smith's, you know, Fox News studio. I mean, I said, boy, are casinos and newsrooms converging? But in any case, as I talked to this very, you know, accomplished and thoughtful bookmaker, odds maker, about his game, I learned a couple of things. The main thing was this, that when we make odds or pollsters make predictions and say that that's a form of odds making, we're not only predicting the future, we're trying to influence it. And by that I mean that in the bookie's case, you're trying to excite people to make bets on two sides, you know, in a game, say. And so you set the odds and you adjust the odds such that the bets are evenly matched on either side, you know. And in that way, you sort of manipulate and arouse energy in the betting public. I think that's true of polls, too, and people have started to realize it. Polls are not purely detached projections of what will happen. They often are, in the way they're emphasized, in the way they're constructed, in the way they're reported on, ways to get people to do things. Maybe suppress turnout by depressing them about the poor prospects of their candidate, or excite turnout by making things seem closer than they might be. And there are so many polls now that you could pretty much pick and choose among them depending on what kind of excitement or lack of excitement you're trying to produce.
Let's go next to Jim Hollandale. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Go ahead, Jim. Hi.
Hi. I don't know. One important factor in all this is where all this money comes through. And we have a huge systematic financial organization that exists in this country. One, the Southern Democratic Leadership Conference, and ALEC on the Republican side. And they, especially with the Koch brothers through ALEC, are attacking all sorts of down ballot races, even courthouse races in some cases. This system is, we just lost another 2,200 jobs in the state of Indiana in a plant that made air conditioners, and they shipped the 2,100 to 2,200 jobs to Mexico, and Oreo cookies on the north side of Chicago are now going to Mexico. So, Bernie was the only hope we had of even beginning to change that. In order to do that, we had to have a major change in the House and the Senate both. And it's a really tough goal we got ahead of us here. So I'd like to hear what you got to say about that.
All right. Thank you, Jim, for your call.
Yeah, well, you know, interestingly, both Sanders and Trump were critics of these trade bills that grease the skids for, the export of jobs and so on. So, if there is any real policy crossover between the two, it's there, and that may be significant for some voters. That carrier plant, you'll remember, I think Trump spoke about, repeatedly. So this anti-free trade movement is one of the commonalities of these two wings.
Are you going to be reporting a lot on the upcoming debates, et cetera? Or are you not going to do that, Walter?
Well, I'm going to the Republican convention.
Are you?
And I was asked to go there at a time when it was thought that it would be, you know, pure mayhem. I think it's going to be actually kind of boring. I think the Republicans are probably almost embarrassed that they have to hold it. I don't have plans to go to the Democratic convention, where I think there may be some actual, trouble and drama.
Mm. Thanks, Walter, for being with us. Walter Kern, author and journalist, has a piece in the June issue of Harper's, The Improbability Party. His work has appeared in New York Times Magazine, the New York Times Book Review, GQ, Vogue, New York, Esquire. And he's also a novelist. His books, Thumbsucker and Up in the Air, have been turned into major motion pictures. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour. And thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Downtown Milwaukee will be the site of a major conference on water next week because, of course, we're on Lake Michigan and there's a water institute in this town, so people are coming from all over the world. We'll talk about water resiliency, hour two.